You are listening to Talking Impact Investing podcast show, and I'm your host, Matej Suchets. Today's episode is brought to you by the Business Department of Rollins College. In this podcast, you will hear unique insights from the industry leaders and upcoming stars on various topics, from sustainability to social responsibility. Impact-driven entrepreneurs and investors on this show will help you expand your knowledge on modern ESG practices and impact investing. Are you ready? Without further ado, let's dive in the episode. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Talking Impact Investing. And today I'm super excited because I'm joined by Alyssa Jade McDonald-Bertel. Now, let me tell you a little bit more about Alyssa. She is a founder of her own company in Germany, which is a social enterprise that focuses on cacao farmer education, as well as advising companies and policymakers around Europe. She's also a board member at CGIAR, which is a research partnership for a food secure future, which strives towards reducing poverty and enhancing nutrition. She's also a board member of the German Federation of Green Economy. And before she started her entrepreneurial journey, she has some experience from corporate world as she worked as a head of international communications at Deutsche Telekom. Alyssa, thank you for joining us today and welcome to Talking Impact Investing.
Thank you, Matej. It's great to meet you. I've enjoyed some of the past podcasts that you've done. Great overview from big corps to impact. Excellent.
Thank you. Well, let's get into the first question. Can you tell us a bit more about what you learned when you started your company in 2008, when I believe firstly it was just setting up farms in Ecuador? What were some of the challenges that you faced there? And then how did you decide for a transition into more like a farmer education rather than producing cacao and luxury chocolate?
Oh, great question, Matej. I started the company. My family comes from Papua New Guinea, so I'm from Southeast Asia and commodity products. In the beginning, we come from rubber farmers. And as a next generation rubber farmer coming out of a developing country, my family, of course, didn't want me to go into more agricultural futures. They wanted me to get educated and go get a job at one of those big fancy companies around the world. And so I had done that. And I would say, Matej, the big pull came from after a decade in energy and telecommunications corporate work, the pull to return to my roots in developmental agriculture was very, very strong. So the purpose to return was high as such, yet I had experienced the world of fancy companies and branding and product development. And I kind of wanted to bring these two worlds together, what we know from Papua New Guinea and producing commodities with our hands, to being able to process them with high value and sell them at a good price. This was my original goal. And in 2009, indeed, I quit my corporate job and started my own social enterprise. We didn't return to Papua New Guinea. We actually went to Ecuador, which at the time was just emerging in the chocolate scene. So we also wanted to go to a country that was just emerging. And in my world, I didn't want to do rubber like my family because I'm a lady and that's not my world. Certainly working on a product that I love like chocolate was key. And I think these are some of the points, Matej, is knowing what your roots are and returning to them, yet redefining it in your own way. So for me, it wasn't rubber, but it was chocolate. And in the beginning, indeed, we produced beautiful bean to bar chocolate. And I sold them for 30 euros for a 50 gram bar in downtown Munich. So it was high end luxury chocolate. We won a lot of prizes and it was great. Yet after some years, I realized in German, we have this word Mühsam, which is just like, it's a hard slog in terms of we were just producing great chocolate. But around us, all the farmers were asking, we want to do that too. How can we be involved? And so we started just training them on the techniques that we were using, which were the ones that my father had taught me. And it became very clear over time that my personal passion wasn't in branding and selling and positioning luxury chocolate in Europe. It was that original return to roots, that working in developmental agriculture, but with the knowledge I had gained from international corporate work. So in about 2014, we moved the organization from producing chocolate to producing cacao farmer education. And indeed, this is much greater tipping point for improving livelihoods, health of families, and also improving quality of the raw material. Not to mention the business advantage. You can probably think of hundreds of chocolate companies around the world, but can you think of any that are focused on farmer education? It's also a smaller sector, which requires a much deeper knowledge. But let's say from a business growth perspective now, my partners and I, we are looking at wanting to serve all 5 million farmers around the world and all 14 million in the value chain. So one could say it became more niche, but then grew in ambition to truly want to serve everybody. Yet on the other side, got out of a very messy, not messy, but a very full marketplace with an offering that we didn't necessarily want to offer. So I would say the learning is follow your roots, identify the true niche, and the purpose. You know, the purpose is always the big goal, no matter how niche or unusual it is. And then you end up doing field schools in the middle of Nicaragua during hurricanes.
Thank you for sharing that very interesting story. I believe you faced many challenges, either with scaling or anything else. Could you talk us how you tackled them and what are you most proud of?
Absolutely. Organic growth, I'm most proud of. In terms of, we chose not to scale via equity. We chose to scale via delivering genuinely great value and then finding the price points and partners within that. Over the time, it's become abundantly clear. So cacao farmer education, let's say in this part of the business, is typically paid for by ministries of agriculture, development banks, or NGOs, such as NGOs that are involved in developmental work. And the price often paid for our service in those areas is often end of the line, low quality, not high prices, let alone the fact that we put huge amount of knowledge and work into our product. So what I would say, what I'm most proud of here is that we found alternate ways to do sustainable financing that genuinely reflects the value that we are bringing to cacao farmers. So cacao farmers can still pay to, for example, participate in our farmer training for 50 cents each or $2 each, which is all they have. And other partners in the chain, such as ministries of agriculture, who still have a low determination of the price, can still pay the price that they are after. But what we managed to do is top up our true cost of product sold via partnerships with tech companies, with impact investors, with those that are interested in the true value chain support of what we do. So what I'm proud of is everybody can participate at the price they can, yet we don't have to cannibalize the quality of our service to deliver that. And often that happens in developmental agriculture. Often it'll be, oh, the price, you know, the revenues that can be earned from this is so very low, then we'll do a low service. And our mindset, what I'm most proud of, is we don't. We say the cacao farmers need the best tech in the world. They need the best plant pathology. They need the best livelihood development strategies. And we will bring them that, and we will take care of financing what is required to bring them that. That is what I'm most proud of.
Awesome. And I also believe that there are different challenges that you face showing your value and educating farmers in the developing countries. Is it technology that is a challenge for them, or is something else? Can you talk about that, please?
Oh, Mate, every single part of the value chain is representing a unique challenge. One that we are working on very strongly at the moment is a middle part of the value chain. So our goal is to bring training and education to farmers of what they want to learn in a way they want to learn. But in the middle of there, remember I mentioned development banks and ministries of agriculture and NGOs? They are the ones that we're having to do some interim upskilling of, because they are still informed of old ways of doing things in terms of farmers are poor, they need the minimum viable information, just give them a farmer field school in the middle of nowhere with the least amount of inputs and materials and they'll get by. So what we're having to do in our education at the moment is we're having to educate further along the value chain. So before, because it doesn't help us to just do training of farmers without the rest of their value chain understanding their needs. Often, I mean, farmers are brilliant. My father was a rubber farmer. He's the smartest person I've met in the world. They are agile. They are smart. They can produce output with the smallest possible inputs. But what we need is that their microfinancing, their material suppliers, their wheelbarrow, their seed plantations, their irrigation suppliers need to be on the same wavelength of them. So what we are doing, for example, right now, we are running a 5-month, literally, FCCI Cacao Academy for development banks. So the development banks that are sitting in the middle of the financing chain between the suppliers to farmers and farmers themselves are actually informed. How is pricing working? How is quality working? What if we actually invest in storage, post-harvest, and mobility for cacao farmers? Can they actually be able to implement the new learning they get and get a higher price for their product? The answer is yes. So one of the challenges is upskilling the value chain so they can actually do their job to better support farmers. And that's what we're doing now.
Very interesting. And you mentioned financing. What about the public investing throughout the European Commission? Could you talk about the importance and the role of that and give us a little bit of a snapshot of the past 5 years in regards to that?
Yes, indeed. Matej, that's another part of our business. So one part of our business is in developmental agriculture and education, and the other part is here in Europe. We supply close-to-market strategy for public and private investors that are interested in investing in eco-innovations. As you hear from our experience in cacao, we come from a very informed area of the business, so we translate those messages across. My favorite public investing instrument in the EU at the moment is something called the LIFE program, which is run by the European Climate Infrastructure and Environment Executive Agency. They are brilliant. They are 25 years old. At the moment, in the current multi-financial framework, they have about 5 billion, of which they put about 400 to 500 million every year across the EU into eco-innovations. Now, the thing is in the past, this fund was set up for classic nature preservation. But as we have seen over the decades, just preservation of environmental and climate topics is not sustainable financing for the future. So what the LIFE program is doing is stimulating close to market activity. Just like the example I gave you with our cacao farming education, we know that one part of the money is going to come from delivering the service, and you need innovative financing models to make a business model out of it. That exists also here in the EU for mobility, water, infrastructure, construction, for food products, for agriculture. And the LIFE program is doing that, and I just love their work there. What's really interesting about the LIFE and why I think they're interesting as a public financing is they are now saying there is revenue, profit, and sustainable financing in climate and environmental products and services, and we want you to go do it. Go make businesses. Eco services. One of our favorite fundies is Climark in the area of Catalonia. It's a public-private partnership between the government of Catalonia and some private academic think tanks that put together a way of managing forest resources for improved fire management, water, and biodiversity, of which they sell as what you might know as a classic carbon credit, climate credit. But the way they've done it is they've taken public money from the LIFE program and created a way to both maintain eco services for the Catalan region, but also produce the revenue to maintain its own eco services costs. This is what LIFE program does very, very well, is with a little bit of public funding, stimulate commercial opportunities for future self-financing programs. I love them.
And when we talk about advising, let me just mention that your programs and plans, market strategies have helped and impacted over 3,000 companies so far, which is something very amazing. Can you tell us more about, are there any common topics that you face or problems that you want to solve?
Brilliant. Yes, indeed. So while we've been advising investors such as these, indeed, we've worked with about 3,000 companies across the EU. And those are eco-innovators who receive either public or private funding to bring their innovation to market. In that niche, what I notice is engineers and scientists that are brilliant, that have exceptional ideas for waste reduction and water optimization and multiple outputs for climate and environmental or social good. They're scientifically or engineering-wise brilliant. Often they're missing that market piece. There's not enough design thinking between the establishment of the great innovation and the actual market need, especially in this environment where sometimes the innovations are occurring before the market mechanisms exist. For example, enabling laws, or a community that's interested, or an ambitious mayor or CEO of a company that wants to actually implement it. So innovations before the market need is necessarily there, that's the problem I'm seeing. And these engineers and scientists need to, and the work I do with them is to much better get in touch with potential clients and customers and stakeholders early on in the design phase, so they don't end up at the end of technical readiness, ready to release, you know, the ultimate perfect widget without a paying customer. They might want it bigger, smaller, longer, fatter, subscription. They might need all sorts of models. And what I'm noticing, we are still far too much getting intellectual property stamped and completed and done without bringing or making a market in the process. I also see this in agricultural innovation as well in developing countries. Similar approach, a bit too much focus on perfecting the innovation and not enough at building the market need along the way.
Thanks for sharing that with us. A very, very good answer and a lot to learn from. Can you tell us more about what is something that you're most excited in the field of eco-innovation? It can be throughout the Europe or around the world.
Oh, yeah. Multi-beneficiary, multi-stakeholder engagements. I see more and more occurring think tanks and academia working with startups, connecting with a multinational, and then doing a partnership with a city. In my opinion, these multi-stakeholder programs are the best way at addressing the issue I mentioned before, stimulating and establishing a market demand, and then creating the opportunity for the innovation to solution it. This will go anywhere from a unique drought-resistant seed in a dry land area, as much as to an innovative cooling system for a factory in a location that needs to create and sustain its own energy. The reason why I see these multi-stakeholder programs so well is, stimulating the market demand, but also it's harder to manage because everybody's got a different reason for being there, and they've got their own interpretation of what's good and bad. It's a harder process, yet it irons out some of the failures and faults in the system along the way, because the municipality is there to give the approval that it can go ahead. You know, the startup is there with that agility to see opportunities and fit the gap. The multinational is there to confirm and be able to guarantee scale. When all of those stakeholders all sign off and say, this is a brilliant idea and we put skin in the game for it, it doesn't guarantee success, but it's a better, better chance. And more I see projects come up for funding that are one or two beneficiary or stakeholder. I have a concern because I see it's going to be an echo chamber. They're going to be looking inward of their own place. They're not bringing along all the partners that they need. In our entirely connected world, we don't exist as single entities anymore.
I love that answer, and thank you for sharing that with us, showing us that there is an optimism in this field and a lot to be achieved. At this point, Elisa, I really want to thank you for taking your time out of your busy schedule to join Talking Impact Investing, sharing your experience and expertise, and also acknowledge you for everything that you're doing in regards to farmer education and everything else in your field. Again, thank you for taking the time out of your schedule and joining Talking Impact Investing.
Thank you, Mate, for building the knowledge around impact investing. I love your podcast. Keep going.
Thank you for staying with us until the very end. You can stay up to date with the upcoming episodes by subscribing. And if you found any useful information, feel free to leave a 5-star review and follow Talking Impact Investing Podcast on social media.